payment. Yes, they're rubbish, but the wall and the walkway look to be pretty solid. The steps need a little strengthening, but they look all right. In fact, it should suit us quite nicely. Horace put his shoulder against the gate and shoved hard. It gave another meter, then stopped. As you say, this needs some oil. Gillen shrugged. Do we want it to open any farther? Horace shoved the door again and opened it an additional few centimetres. We'll need to get the horses inside, he said. Gillen pursed his lips. He had forgotten that detail. Then a thought struck him. How do we get them up that final vertical wall? By dint of much pushing and heaving and scrambling, Horace told him. If all else fails, we'll dig out a ramp for them. Dismissing the matter of the gate, he strode into the inner compound. He drew his sword and held it casually beside him. Gillen raised his eyebrows. I don't think there's anyone here, he said mildly. Horace inclined his head. Never hurts to be sure, he said. He stopped by the smaller of the huts. Its walls sagged, and the roof timbers had largely collapsed. The door, warped and full of gaps, hung haphazardly by one hinge. He set his foot against the doorpost and pushed. There was a creaking of old timbers and a groan as the fastening pegs gave way, and the entire front wall crashed down in a cloud of dust and splinters. That, of course, was the commander's quarters, Gillen said. Horace sniffed disdainfully. I'll make do with a tent, he said. In fact, we all will. They took another 10 minutes to explore the interior of the fort. Not that there was a great deal to see. It had obviously been unused for many years. There was a well in one corner, close to the gate, surrounded by a low stone parapet and covered with a circular wooden hatch. When Gillen slid the old, rotting wooden cover aside and tossed a pebble down, they heard a splash of water far below. Horace leaned over the dark hole and sniffed the air. There was no smell of corruption or rot. He saw an old wooden beaker hanging on a frayed cord beside the parapet and carefully lowered it down, mindful that the cord could break at any time. He felt the beaker touch the water and moved the cord gently so that the container tipped and filled. Then he retrieved it, sniffed the half-full contents and tasted it. Water's clean, he said. That's handy, Gillen replied. He peered over the edge of the well's parapet. He thought he could see a tiny circle of light reflecting from the black surface far below. He stepped back. There were 4 large barrels standing close by. He checked them, but they were empty. What are these for? He asked. Horace shrugged. Maybe for taking supplies of water to different points around the wall, he said. He set the beaker down and looked around once more, satisfied with what he saw. We'll set up our tents in here, he said. Let's bring the others up. Gillen smiled. You can do that, he said. I'll stay here and keep watch. Horace eyed him. In other words, you don't feel like going down that steep path and scrambling back up again. Gillen held out his hands ingenuously. You're the commander. It's your prerogative to lead the troops, he said. Horace rolled his eyes. As you say, I'm the commander. I could order you to do it while I take it easy up here. You know us rangers, Gillen replied. We're notoriously bad when it comes to obeying orders. But Horace was already striding back toward the gate. 27. The hunting party assembled in the Castle Araluen courtyard the following morning, just as the sun was rising over the tops of the trees at the base of the hill. The 3 Scandians were already waiting, when Maddie and Cassandra emerged from the keep tower. Maddie and Cassandra were accompanied by Daimon. He was armed with a hunting bow, a solid weapon, but not as long or as powerful as the war bows carried by the castle's archers or the ranger corps. The two princesses were armed with their slings, and each had a bulging pouch of lead shot at her belt. In case of emergencies, Maddie was also carrying a bow slung over her shoulder, with a draw weight of only 40 pounds. It was not as powerful as the recurve bow she used as a ranger, so it didn't have the range and hitting power. But it would be useful enough for hunting. The sling wasn't suitable for all forms of game, she knew. Daimon smiled when he saw the bow. "What do you expect to hit with that?" he asked. He had seen the standard of Maddie's archery, or at least he thought he had. She shrugged. "You never know. I might get lucky." He shook his head. "Not sure there's that much luck in the world." Stig and Thorn were both armed with heavy spears. Hal had a crossbow slung over his back. Cassandra had arranged for it to be fetched from the ship by the servants who took food to the rest of the Heron's crew. "Good morning, gentlemen," Cassandra said cheerfully, and they replied with a chorus of greetings. "I trust you slept well." Stig grimaced cheerfully. "I find it hard to get used to the fact that my bed isn't moving when I come ashore after a long voyage," he said, "although it feels as if it is." Hal agreed with Stig. "It takes a while to get your land legs back. By contrast, when we're on board the ship, it feels as if it's not moving at all," he said. "We'll be rolling around as if we're drunk for a day or so." "Why is that?" Maddie asked. She had no experience of sailing or ships, and was finding their observations interesting. The two Scandians shrugged. "Nobody knows," Stig said. "It just happens that way. I guess we get used to the ship rolling, and when that's not happening anymore, we somehow think it is." The seventh member of the party was Olwyn, a grizzled old forester who had hunted the woods around Castle Araluin for the past 30 years. He would act as their guide on the hunt, seeking out and following the tracks left by game, deer, rabbits and hares, and wildfowl. He carried a bow and had a long-bladed hunting knife in a scabbard on his belt. He was accompanied by his hunting dog, Dougal, a rather scruffy beast of indeterminate lineage, who lolled his tongue at them. Dougal was getting on in years, and he had a stiff rear leg, but that didn't dampen his enthusiasm for hunting, fetching game, and tracking. Olwyn had known Cassandra since she was a girl, and was totally devoted to her. He nodded a greeting as he joined them. "Morning, Your Highness," he said. Cassandra smiled at him as she leaned down to scratch Dougal's floppy ears. "Good morning, Olwyn. I trust you'll be able to find us some game today." He nodded several more times. "That'll be so, my lady. We'll strike out down to the lake, where we should find geese and ducks." He nodded at the sling coiled under her belt. "You should be able to bring down a few with that sling of yours. Then we'll angle over toward Sentinel Hill. There's been deer sighted there in the last few days." "Sighted by whom?" Maddie asked. He grinned knowingly at her. "Why, by me, my young lady," he said. She nodded to herself. She would have expected him to go out the previous day and search for the best hunting spots for them. Olwyn looked around, making sure everyone was ready. "Shall we go?" Out of deference to the Scandians, they had elected not to ride. They walked across the drawbridge and headed downhill toward the forest, Olwyn leading the way. The grass was still wet with dew, and looking behind them, Maddie could see the dark tracks they were leaving as they displaced the moisture from the grass. They passed the small grove that masked the entrance to the tunnel under the moat, and she surreptitiously studied her companions to see if anyone noticed anything unusual about the spot. Nobody did, of course. People had been walking past that hidden tunnel for years without seeing anything out of the ordinary. Ulwin led them slightly to the right, and she was relieved to see they would pass well clear of the glade where Bumper was tethered. She doubted that anyone else would sense his presence, but she couldn't be sure of Ulwin or Dougal. She started suddenly as she heard the whirr of Cassandra's sling beside her, and the hiss of her shot as she let fly. A hare had broken cover in the grass 10 meters ahead of them. It had barely reached half speed when the lead shot smacked into it and bowled it over. "Stay awake," her mother told her. Maddie made an appreciative gesture with her hands. "Good shot," she said, and the Scandians chorused their agreement. Cassandra smiled a little smugly, it has to be admitted. "Even with my faulty technique?" Maddie shook her head with a tired grin. She and her mother used totally different techniques with their slings, and Maddie had always held that Cassandra's was less efficient and slower than her own. Her mother was obviously delighted that she had scored before her daughter, beating her to the shot. Ulwin gathered the hare into his game bag, and they moved on into the trees. "What's wrong with Cassandra's technique?" Hal asked. Maddie sniffed. "Just about everything. She makes up for bad technique with extraordinary good luck." "Ha!" her mother snorted, and gave her a superior smile. Maddie held her tongue. "We'll see what's what when we reach the lake," she thought to herself. But to her chagrin, when she and Cassandra let fly at 2 rising ducks, her shot grazed the tail of the one she aimed at, doing no more than knocking a feather loose, whereas her mother's target dropped like a stone into the lake as her shot hit dead centre. In spite of his stiff rear leg, Dougal bounded away, hurling himself into the lake and churning the water to retrieve the fallen bird. "Ha!" said Cassandra again, as Dougal dropped the duck at her feet. Maddie reddened, but said nothing. Again, Ulwin gathered the prize into his game bag. Thorn watched the byplay between the two women with amusement. "So," he said to Maddie, "your mother whirls her sling around her head horizontally 2 or 3 times and then releases. You don't do that. You let it fall back behind your shoulder, then you step forward and whip the sling overhead to release it." He looked at Hal, who was always interested in the mechanics of weaponry. "Sort of like the way Lydia uses her atlatl, isn't it?" Hal agreed. "No whirling," he said. Maddie regarded them both, not sure if they were teasing her, and felt the heat rising in her cheeks. "It's more efficient my way," she said, trying to sound objective. "All that whirling and whirring wastes time and gives game a chance to escape, or an enemy to shoot first." "I can see that," Hal replied solemnly. "Yet," said Cassandra, "here am I with a duck and a hare in the bag, and you, with your superior method, have downed how many?" "Oh, that's right," she said. "Precisely none." "The day isn't over yet, Mother," Maddie told her, speaking very precisely. They moved on from the lake. The other ducks and geese there had all taken flight, and it would be some time before they settled to the water again. The hunting party headed toward Sentinel Hill, and Maddie began to see signs that deer had passed this way recently. She didn't let on that she'd seen the tracks. That would be a little out of character for a princess. But it was evident that Ulwin had noticed them, and she saw him nodding contentedly to himself. He appeared to have missed something else, though, and she thought it might be important that he knew about it. She pointed to several long gashes in the bark of a tree, low down and close to the ground. "What caused this, Ulwin?" she asked ingenuously.
"Why, that was well spotted, my lady," Ulwin said.
He went down on one knee and touched the slashes. Maddie could see from where she stood that the sap on the disturbed bark was dry. The marks were many hours old. Ulwin looked up at her.
"I saw these yesterday when I was scouting," he said. "A boar did this, my lady."
She made her eyes widen. "A wild boar?" she asked breathlessly. The old hunter smiled grimly.
"Well, we don't have any tame ones around here, Lady Madeline, but he'll be long gone by now," he said reassuringly.
But Maddie had noticed something that the old hunter seemed to have missed. There were several more slashes on an adjacent tree, and the sap was still oozing wetly in them. "What about those?" she asked. Ulwin looked, then frowned.
"Hmm," he said thoughtfully. "Those were made today, and not so long ago."
Then he raised his voice to speak to the rest of the group.
"Eyes open, everyone. We don't want to come upon this one without seeing him first."
Thorn had watched the interplay between the young princess and Ulwin. He wasn't taken in by her pretended ignorance.
"You knew perfectly well what those marks were," he thought. "And you wanted the rest of us to be on the alert for the boar."
Maddie turned suddenly and caught him looking at her. He grinned and tapped one finger along the side of his nose. She frowned at him, suspecting that he'd seen through her play-acting, then shook her head and turned away. They moved on through the trees. Conscious that the boar might be close to them, and knowing that the sling would be virtually useless against it, she had coiled up the weapon and tucked it into her belt. Instead, she knocked an arrow to the bowstring and held the bow loosely, ready to shoot if necessary. Diamond saw the movement and smiled to himself once more, shaking his head. They were working in a large half-circle, planning to return to the lake, where the ducks might have resettled. Hal sighted a small deer and shot it with his crossbow. It was a good shot. The little animal leapt into the air, ran half a dozen paces, then fell dead. Ulwin quickly field-dressed it, and Thorn and Stig tied its four legs over a stout sapling, carrying it between them. Maddie estimated they were halfway back to the lake when Dougal began barking frantically and darted forward toward a dense thicket of bushes at the far side of the clearing they were crossing. The hunters stopped, startled by his sudden outburst. From the thicket, they could hear the movement of a large, heavy body crashing into the bushes and branches, and hear an enraged, threatening squeal.
"It's the boar!" Ulwin yelled, then called to his frantic, near-hysterical dog. "Dougal! Back away now! Back away!"
But Dougal paid him no heed. The old dog darted forward towards the thicket. Shoving his head between the dense-growing bushes and barking non-stop, the noises from within the thicket increased, and then suddenly Dougal turned tail and retreated, as a shaggy, dark figure erupted from the bushes and charged after him. The little dog tried to dodge, but his stiff back leg betrayed him, and he stumbled so that the boar was upon him. It butted its head into his ribs, and he squealed in frightened pain as the impact threw him several meters. The hunters began to move in. Stig and Thorn dropped the carcass of the deer and moved forward, spears raised. Hal brought up his crossbow, and Diamond knocked an arrow to his bow. Alwyn was panicking, terrified that his dog would be injured. Luckily, the boar had not used its tusks so far. The boar dashed forward, and Dougal managed to leap awkwardly to one side, evading the slashing tusks. As the two animals moved round each other, one slashing and squealing, the other dodging awkwardly, none of the hunters had a clear shot or cast at the boar, except Maddie. For 3 years, she had been trained to recognize and take advantage of a split-second opportunity. Now she had one, as Dougal backed away and the boar hesitated, drawing back on its haunches and preparing for a final charge. She drew, sighted, and released in one fluid movement. The arrow flashed across the clearing and thudded home, penetrating deep behind the boar's left shoulder and tearing into its heart. The savage beast squealed once, reared onto its hind legs, then fell dead on the grass, its legs sticking out stiffly. Instantly, Maddie let out a panicked squeal of her own and let the bow drop to the ground in front of her. When the others realized where the arrow had come from, they turned to face her. But she was standing, shaking, her hands covering her eyes, and calling frantically. "What happened? What happened? Did I hit it?" Her companions heaved a collective sigh of relief. The tension went out of the clearing as they looked again at the dead boar. "You hit it all right, my lady," said Ulwin. "Killed it, stone dead." Stig and Hal echoed his words of praise. Diamond looked on in utter disbelief. Maddie took her hands from her eyes and looked at Alwyn, wide-eyed. "I did?" she said in tones of total surprise. "But I had my eyes shut."
"She did at that," said a voice behind her. "Had them shut tight the whole time."
It was Thorn. She realized that the old Scandian had been standing behind her, and had likely witnessed the entire event, had seen her cool, disciplined handling of the bow, then her pretense at panic as she hurled it to the ground. She met his gaze now as Diamond knelt beside the boar and shook his head.
"If that's the case, that was the luckiest shot I've ever seen," Diamond said slowly.
As Maddie studied the old sea wolf, he let one eye slide shut in a surreptitious wink.
"If you don't want 'em to know, I'm not saying anything," the movement said.
They circled back to the lake, with Diamond and Hal carrying the boar, and Stig and Thorn with the deer between them. They'd be hard put to carry any more large animals, and Hal looked appreciatively at the two carcasses.
"Edwin will be pleased," he said.
"That's plenty of fresh meat for the trip home." They added to their bag at the lake, with Cassandra bringing down 3 more ducks, and Maddie accounting for a goose and a mallard. Dougal, thoroughly chastened now, brought the birds ashore for them. "And there's tonight's dinner taken care of," Cassandra said with a satisfied smile. They dined on roast goose that night in the refectory adjoining the kitchens. The rest of the Heron's crew were summoned to join them, and it was a festive and cheerful occasion, marred only slightly by the fact that Diamond hurriedly excused himself, on the pretext of duty. Maddie noted again that he seemed somewhat uncomfortable around the Scandians. She puzzled over it for a few minutes, then dismissed it. Hal and his crew were excellent company, boisterous and cheerful, with a fund of exciting stories to tell. If Diamond chose to be prickly around them, That was his problem. They were demolishing a fig pudding after the main meal when a servant entered and spoke quietly to Cassandra. She listened, then pointed out Hal. The servant moved down the table to where the Skrull was waiting expectantly. "Captain Hal, there's a messenger here for you. He's a Scandian, and he says it's urgent." He nodded toward the door leading to the stairway, where a figure could be seen waiting just outside. Hal glanced interrogatively at Cassandra, who nodded. Then he beckoned to the waiting man. "Come in," he said, and, as the newcomer moved out of the shadows into the light, he recognized him. "Is that you, Sten Engelsson?"
"Yes, Hal, it's me all right."
Hal turned to Cassandra and explained. "Sten is the first mate on Wolfbiter."
"Wolfbiter?" Cassandra said. "Isn't she the..."
"The current duty ship, yes," Hal told her. "Jern Icerunner is her Skrull. We spoke with Jern 2 days ago when we reached the mouth of the Semeth, where she was patrolling." He turned his attention back to Sten. "Is there a problem?" he asked, although, as he said it, he realized that Sten would hardly be here if there wasn't.
"Wolfbiter is damaged, Hal," Sten said. "She went on to Barrier Rocks, south of the Semeth. A rogue wave picked her up and dumped her heavily. Jern managed to get her to the beach, but he thinks her back might be broken. He wants you to take a look before he decides to abandon her."
Stig leaned toward Maddie and said in a low aside, "Hal is an expert shipbuilder as well as a Skrull. If Wolfbiter can be repaired, he'll be able to tell them." Hal was rubbing his chin.
"I'd best go and take a look," he said.
Then he turned to Cassandra. "We'll leave straight away, my lady," he said. "That way, we'll just catch the outgoing tide. I don't like the idea of the duty ship being out of action any longer than it has to be."
Cassandra nodded.
"Neither do I.
With this Red Fox clan disrupting things," she said. "How long do you think you'll be?"
Hal paused, screwing up his eyes while he considered the problem.
"A week, maybe 10 days at the most. If we have to abandon her, I'll need to bring her crew back with us, and we'll need to provision the ship for the trip home. We can finalize the details for the archers then, too," he added as an afterthought.
"I'll have the papers ready to sign, Hal, and I'll have the boar and your deer salted and ready to go as well," Cassandra said.
Hal nodded his thanks, then turned to his crew. "Right, lads, we'd better be moving. The tide won't wait for us, and it'll be hard rowing if it turns."
There was a clatter as benches were pushed back from the table, and the Heron's crew rose to their feet and began making their way toward the door. Stig paused halfway and turned back, reaching across the table to tear a leg from the carcass of the goose. He ripped a large chunk off with his teeth and grinned at Maddie.
"I never waste good food," he said.
Hal snorted derisively.
"You never waste any food," he said. "Now let's get moving."
28. By dint of much pushing, pulling, and swearing, they got the horses up the last part of the hill and into the fort. The supply wagon was a different matter. The vertical wall was too high and too steep, and Horace was disinclined to waste time building a ramp for the wagon. In the end, he had it unloaded and left it on the path below the gate.
"If the foxes try to mount an attack, we can always push it over the edge and let it run down on them," he said.
While Horace had been bringing the rest of the force up the hill, Gillen had discovered the use intended for the barrels. There were four drains dug along the front wall of the palisade, two on either side of the gate, spaced 5 meters apart. He experimented by pouring a bucket of water down one of them. A minute or so later, he saw a stream of water spurt from the edge of the path.
If we pour water down them, it'll wet the grass slope below the last section of path, he told Horace. That'll make it even harder for the enemy to climb.
Horace nodded, grinning at the ingenuity of the original designers. He had the barrels moved so that they stood by the four drains, then set a party of men to filling them with water. Initially, the old dried-out seams leaked profusely, but as the water soaked into the staves and expanded them, the leaks slowed to a trickle. Night fell, and the men lit cooking fires. The supply wagon had carried bags of grain for the horses. If they rationed it carefully, it would last a week or so. The horses would be hungry, and their fitness and strength would suffer. But they were unlikely to be mounting a cavalry charge while they were in the fort. Horace posted sentries around the walls, with strict instructions to wake him if there was any sight or sound of the enemy arriving. He considered it unlikely, however. "If you're right," he told Gillen, as they sat by a small fire nursing mugs of hot coffee, "they will have waited for nightfall to cross the river. My guess is that they would have camped on the meadow by the river for the night. They'd hardly want to go blundering through the forest in the dark in case we were waiting in ambush for them."
"Maybe that's what we should have done," Gillen suggested. But Horace shook his head.
"Night battles are too risky. Too many things can go wrong. We might thin their numbers out, but we could lose a lot of our own men, and we don't have a lot to lose. So we wait here for them. We wait here for them, and see what they have in mind."
"You think they'll attack?" Gillen asked.
Horace looked deep into the fire before he answered. "I think so," he said. "They'll have to test our strength at least once. But they'll take a lot of casualties if they do. My guess is, once they've tried, they'll pull back and surround the hill. We don't have enough men to mount a frontal attack on them, so we can hardly break out. Which means, if we don't get help, we'll be bottled up here," Gillen said thoughtfully. His friend nodded. "And I'm beginning to think that's what they've had in mind all along."
Gillen frowned.
"What makes you think that?"
"There are a lot more of them than we expected," Horace replied. "And they're better organized than we were led to believe, and better armed. Maybe this whole thing was designed to get us out of Castle Araluin and leave the garrison weakened."
Gillen took a deep sip of his coffee and thought about what Horace had said.
"That makes sense," he said at length.
"But Araluin is a tough nut to crack, even with half the garrison missing. Diamond is a good man, and, of course, Cassandra has been in her share of fights over the years. If there's an attack, they'll be able to hold out."
"I suppose so," said Horace. But he didn't sound happy about the prospect.
"And in the meantime, we're stuck here, sitting on top of a hill and out of the way."
Neither man said anything for a few minutes, and then Horace added,
"And nobody knows we're here." The enemy column arrived an hour after first light. Horace and Gillen stood on the catwalk inside the palisade, peering down the hill to the flat land below, as the files of men marched out of the forest and formed up on the open grassland.
"There's a few less than there used to be," Gillen remarked.
Horace grunted. "Still more than 130 of them. They still outnumber us more than 3 to 1. Three officers rode forward, stopping at the base of the hill, where the track began its sinuous path upward. Gillen could make out the leader from the day before in the centre. The white bandage and sling on his right arm stood out in the early morning light. The man urged his horse forward and started up the steep spiral path, shading his eyes with his unwounded hand and peering up at the fort high above him. "Think he knows we're here?" the ranger asked, not really expecting an answer. But Horace gestured to the smoke from their cooking fires, thin grey columns that rose unwaveringly in the still morning air. "Oh, he knows all right," he said. He glanced across the fort, making sure there were lookouts on all four walls, ready to keep an eye on the enemy leader as he spiralled upward, with the other two officers following his lead. The three riders pushed on, leaning forward in their saddles against the slope, and disappeared from sight around the first curve in the track. Horace called to a sergeant on the west wall. "Got them in sight, sergeant." The sergeant waved acknowledgement. "In sight, sir. Still coming up." A few minutes later, his opposite number on the rear north wall raised a hand. "Enemy in sight, sir. Still claiming." Then, as the three riders continued up and around the hill, a similar warning came from the eastern wall. There were five men stationed at each wall, three troopers and two archers. As the enemy came into sight, one of the archers on the east wall held up a hand. "Try a shot, sir," he called. But Gillen motioned for him to stand down. The enemy leader would be within long bowshot now, but he would be aware of the danger, and would certainly have his shield in position to intercept any arrows from above. "Save your arrows," Gillen called back. The archer shrugged, a little disappointed. Gillen turned to Horace. "Pity Maddie's not here with her sling. A lead shot bouncing off his helmet might give him pause." Horace grunted non-committally. He didn't share Gillen's wish that Maddie were here with them. This was a dangerous situation, and not one he wanted his daughter to be involved in. "Coming into sight now, sir," called the lookout at the eastern end of their wall, and within a few seconds, the trio of riders appeared around the bend. They were on the second top tier of the path. One more pass around the hill would bring them up to the top level. "Get ready to put a warning shot past his ear," Horace said, and Gillen stepped forward, drawing an arrow from his quiver. "That's far enough," Horace shouted. A second later, Gillen drew back and released. The arrow hissed down, passing within half a meter of the fox leader's face. He jerked hurriedly on the reins and brought his horse to a stop. As Gillen had predicted, his long triangular shield was deployed on his right side, the side facing the fort, covering most of his body and legs. His head was covered by a full-face helmet. He reached awkwardly with his left hand, now holding the reins, and pushed up his visor. "I'll give you one chance to surrender," he shouted. His voice was surprisingly high-pitched, although that might have been because of the tension he was feeling. "One chance only." "And then?" Horace replied. The man gestured to his troops at the base of the hill. "You can't hope to escape," he said. "We outnumber you 4-1. You're stuck here on this hill."
"And we're quite content to stay here," Horace told him,
although, after the thoughts he'd expressed earlier, that wasn't true.
"If you have so many men, why don't you come and drive us out of here?"
His best chance was to goad the enemy into making an attack. The hill was an excellent defensive position, and Gillen's archers could decimate any attacking force.
"I've got a question for you," the fox leader shouted, anger evident in his voice. "While you're twiddling your thumbs up here, what do you think is happening at Castle Araluen?"
Horace's expression darkened. That was what he had been worried about. He was being held here, unable to do anything constructive, and Castle Araluen was left vulnerable to attack. But he wasn't going to play into the enemy's hands by debating that position.
"I've got a question for you," he called in return. "How are you planning to get back down that hill?"
The rider was stunned into silence for a second or two. In a quiet voice, Gillen spoke to the two archers on the south wall.
"Archers, forward."
The two archers stepped forward to the edge of the palisade. Below them, the rider saw the two heads appear above the wooden wall, their bows in plain sight. His horse snorted, sensing his sudden fear, and tried to rear. He held it in check, cursing it. Then he called to Horace.
"You can't shoot me! I came here for a parley!"
Horace smiled grimly.
"I didn't invite you," he said, "and I don't see any flag of truce. I'm perfectly within my rights to order my men to shoot."
The fox leader, having got his horse under control, was backing it nervously down the path. If he turned, his shield would be on the downhill side, exposing him completely to arrows from the wall. He would have to switch the shield to his left arm again, and that would be a slow, clumsy movement, with his right arm injured and bandaged. Gillen knew that Horace would never order his men to shoot at a virtually helpless man, even an enemy.
"Might save us some trouble if we did kill him," he suggested mildly.
But Horace shook his head.
"Someone else would take command," he said, "and he might know what he's doing."
"So we let him go?" Gillen asked.
He had been trained by Holt, who had no false illusions about honour or fair treatment for an enemy. So far as Holt was concerned, if you had your enemy at a disadvantage, you didn't let him off the hook. Horace turned a hard look on him, knowing what he was thinking, but refusing to be swayed from what he knew to be right.
"We let him go," he said. Then he added, "For now."
29. Life at the castle went back to its uneventful routine after the departure of the noisy, irreverent Scandians. Maddie found herself wishing that they had stayed longer. They had brought a breath of fresh air to the castle. However, she had work to do, and the following evening she set out to keep watch at the old abbey. She waited till the castle had settled down for the evening, then crept surreptitiously down to the cellars. As before, she took a full lantern with her. She also took her sling and her sacks, and she wore her ranger cloak over her normal day wear of jerkin, leggings, and boots. She let herself into the concealed chamber at the end of the cellar, pausing to light her lantern from one of the lamps that were kept burning there. She eased the concealed door shut behind her, confident now that she would be able to open it on her return the following morning. Then, holding the lantern high, she set out down the sloping, uneven path that led under the moat. Knowing what to expect this time, she was unfazed by the dripping water that ran down the tunnel walls as she passed beneath the moat. As before, she felt the tunnel angling upward as she passed beneath the moat, and out onto dry ground once more. There were still bundles of roots hanging through the ceiling of the tunnel, and she used her sacks to clear them away. She'd almost certainly be passing through here again on subsequent nights, and she didn't enjoy the sensation of having them suddenly loom out of the darkness and clutch at her face and hair. This time, with only dim starlight outside, she didn't see the circle of light shining as she approached the end of the tunnel, and it came as something of a shock to reach the tangle of bushes at the exit. Realizing that her lantern would shine like a beacon in the dark, she quickly extinguished it before exiting the tunnel. She pushed the bushes back into place across the entrance, concealing it from outside view, then set off down the hill to the spot where she'd left Bumper. Conscious that there were lookouts posted on all the castle walls, she moved carefully in a half-crouch, making use of all available cover. She also kept her camouflaged cloak wrapped around herself and her cowl up. In the dim light, the moon was yet to rise. It was highly unlikely that anyone would notice the indistinct figure moving slowly and silently through the knee-high grass of the park. Still, she breathed a sigh of relief when she reached the tree line and disappeared into the concealing shadows there. She stood upright and made her way to the hidden glade where Bumper was waiting for her, his ears pricked. He had obviously heard her coming, but, as he had been trained to do, remained silent until she spoke first. "Pleased to see me?" she asked, rubbing his silky nose and handing him the carrot he knew she would be carrying. He nickered softly, then crunched the carrot contentedly. She glanced around the small clearing. Everything here seemed to be in order. His feed bag hung from a branch, and when she checked it, she saw it was still half full. The water bucket was nearly empty. She'd fill it when they returned. He could always make his own way to the small stream nearby, of course, but she preferred to leave water handy for him. Quickly she saddled him and swung up into the saddle. Her bow was in its bow case, strapped to the saddle. She took it out to check that it was undamaged and the string was still firm, with no sign of dampness or unravelling. Satisfied that all was well, she slid it back into the bow case. Then, touching her heels lightly to Bumper's sides, she set out down the twisting game trail for the abbey. She dismounted when they were 20 meters from the clearing where the abbey stood, and left Bumper behind as she crept silently forward through the trees. There was no sign of anyone in the clearing, and she turned her head this way and that, listening carefully for any sound, any hint that there were people inside the abbey. Nothing. She walked back to Bumper and held her finger to her lips, then pointed to the ground at his feet. The message was clear. Be silent and stay here. He tossed his head in acknowledgement, and she turned to creep back to the abbey. There was open ground for 15 meters between the edge of the forest and the building. She felt an almost overwhelming temptation to cross it slowly and furtively, but that wouldn't serve any purpose. Slow movement wouldn't conceal her from any potential observer. Taking care to make no noise, she stepped lightly across the clear ground until she was beside the door. She noted that it was now closed, yet she remembered leaving it slightly open last time she had been here. Could have been the wind, she thought, but she doubted it. It was more likely that someone had closed the door behind them. And that meant that Warwick's informant had been right. There had been people here recently. Question was, were any of them still here? Only one way to find out, she thought. Leaning forward, she pushed against the door with her left hand, her right hand touching the hilt of her sax. The door gave easily. Someone had obviously oiled it. And that indicated that they planned to use the abbey again in the future. She let it swing open, hanging back and waiting to see if there was any reaction from inside. Again, nothing. Drawing her sacks, she stepped quickly through the door opening and moved to one side, out of the doorway. There was no sound from the abbey, no challenging voice, no urgent scuffling of feet as someone moved to take cover. She waited until her eyes were accustomed to the gloom and peered around, searching the interior in sections. There was no sign of anyone. Aware that she had been holding her breath, she let it out in a long sigh and resheathed her sacks. The old farmer who had reported seeing people here had said he had seen them around midnight, and Warwick's previous observations agreed with that timing. That meant she had at least an hour to wait to see if anyone turned up. She moved down the body of the church and climbed the rickety stairs to the choir gallery. From there, she'd have a good view of the entire building and still be able to remain concealed. She settled down on the floor beside the front bench in the gallery, behind the solid timber balustrade, made herself as comfortable as possible, and settled in to wait. The moon had risen now, and was shining at an oblique angle through the window set beside the gallery. She woke with a start, realizing that she must have dozed off. She looked at the window. There was no sign of the moon, yet she knew it had risen. She had been awake when that had happened, watching the pale silver light flood through the window across the interior of the old church. Cautiously, she raised her head, making sure the abbey was still deserted. "Fine ranger you are," she said, thinking of the scathing rebuke she would have received from Will for falling asleep on watch. On the wall opposite the gallery window was a high slit in the stonework, no more than an arrow slit, really. She looked at that now, and could see the moon's light sending a narrow, high-angled shaft across the building. The moon had risen, passed across the church, and was now descending on the far side. She estimated that she'd been asleep for at least 2 hours. At least she could be confident that there had been no sign of the Red Fox clan while she had been asleep. "I'm not so dopey that I could sleep through the noise made by a whole bunch of people gathering there below me," she said. But it was scant comfort. The unavoidable fact was, she had fallen asleep while she was supposed to be on watch. She rose now, stretching her cramped limbs. She had slept with her head at an angle, without any proper support, and her neck ached. She rolled her head and shoulders, trying to ease the stiffness, but without much success. She climbed down the ladder stairs to the floor of the abbey and headed for the door. She made one last inspection to make sure that the building had remained unoccupied, and there was no sign that anyone else had been in here in the past few hours. Nothing seemed to have changed, and the rough sketch of the fox mask was still in place. She checked around the doorway, but there was no sign of the dust and dirt there having been disturbed. No sign of footprints anywhere. "Just as well for you," she muttered. Even though she was sure there was nobody else around, she checked carefully before she left the abbey, then moved quickly across the open ground to the shelter of the trees, where Bumper waited patiently for her.
"Fell asleep, did you?"
he asked, and she wondered how he knew. "Just resting my eyes," she said, "just for a few minutes."
"Ha!"
She knew she could never fool her horse, so she said nothing, resigned to letting him have the moral victory. Yet again. She swung up into the saddle and turned his head for home. There was no point in waiting here any longer. All reported sightings of activity at the Abbey had taken place before midnight, and she judged it was well after that now. We'll just have to come back again tomorrow, and the night after that, if necessary, she told Bumper.
So long as you get a good night's sleep, he replied.
She chose to ignore him.
30. For the next 2 nights, Maddie kept watch in the Abbey, but with no result. There was no sign of the Red Fox clan, no sign of any movement in the forest around the old Abbey, no sign of anything. She wondered briefly if she should tell Cassandra of her suspicions, but decided against it. Not yet, anyway. She wasn't completely sure why she didn't want to tell Cassandra. Possibly, she realized, her mother would quiz her about how she was leaving the castle at night without being seen or challenged by the sentries. And that would lead to her revealing the existence of the tunnel under the moat, which her mother would want to examine, and, being a mother, would probably put off limits. Besides, once Cassandra knew about the tunnel and explored it, it was inevitable that others would learn of its existence, and Maddie wasn't ready for that to happen yet. Additionally, she had in mind an incident that had taken place 18 months previously. She had been convinced that she had stumbled upon a robber's lair in the forest, close to Redmond. But when she had sounded the alarm and led a patrol of the castle guard to the spot, the robbers had turned out to be innocent tinkers. She didn't want to risk the same embarrassment this time. She was determined to make sure of her facts before she involved other people. It would be better to have something definite to report. On the fourth night, Maddie waited in her room until the castle had settled for the night. It took a little longer than usual. For a start, Cassandra had wanted to talk when they were having their usual after-dinner coffee together. Then, for some reason, there was a lot of movement in the castle, with a lot of people on the stairs and in the public rooms. Once things had calmed down, she crept quietly into the cellar and made her way through the tunnel again.
You're late.
Bumper's tone was mildly accusatory as she made her way into the little clearing where he waited for her. I dozed off, she explained. It's fine for you. You can sleep all day if you want to.
Sleep is overrated,
Bumper told her. It occurred to her that he found quite a few things overrated. Only for those who can sleep all day, she replied. She saddled him quickly and mounted, moving off through the trees at a brisk trot to make up lost time. They were familiar with the track now and could move more freely. They reached the Abbey and she dismounted, leaving Bumper in the trees. There was no need to instruct him to wait now. He knew the routine.
Take care.
He sensed that she was becoming accustomed to having nothing happen at the Abbey. That could lead to inattention. I will, she replied, and ghosted through the trees to the edge of the clearing where the old stone church stood. As before, she stopped and listened before gliding silently across to the entrance. The previous night, she had placed a leaf in the door jamb as she closed it. It was still in place, telling her that nobody had entered the Abbey in her absence. She opened the door and slipped inside. She didn't need to pause to let her eyes accustom themselves to the dimness now. The interior of the building was familiar to her, and she made her way quickly to the stairs, up to the gallery. As she had done on the previous 3 nights, she sank to the floor in front of the first pew, concealed from the body of the church by the solid oak balustrade at the front of the gallery. Previously, she had pierced a hole in the panelling with the point of her sacks. This gave her a way of viewing what was going on in the church without revealing herself. She settled herself, finding an uncomfortable position where the arm of the pew dug into her back. She had discovered that this kept her awake as she sat, unmoving, for several hours each night. She checked the moon position. It was considerably higher tonight than it had been originally, shining down through the gallery window at a steep angle. It wouldn't be long before it passed over the building and shone down through the... below her. She heard the door ease open. Someone was here.